This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Eek. The race to develop a vaccine for COVID-19 is pretty reminiscent of the space race to the moon during the Cold War in the 1960s. You know, the country that gets there first gets to vaccinate its population first. But where does that leave Malaysia? Do we have the capacity for vaccine R&D as well as mass production? And where does our lack of capacity leave us with regard to our health security? So we are discussing this today with my co-host Azrul Mohamad Khalid, CEO from the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, as well as Professor Sibrant Popama, the Tan Sri Jeffrey Chia Distinguished Professor who he specializes in immunopathology. And he's also the President Emeritus of the University of Groningen, one of the Netherlands' oldest universities. He's also a member of the board of Sunway University here in Malaysia, as well as special advisor to the Chancellor and the CEO of Sunway Education Group. We are very honored and privileged to have you join us today, Professor.
I'm very happy.
And Professor, maybe you could just catch us up on how is your home country, the Netherlands, doing in terms of coping with COVID-19?
Yeah, that's a question that I cannot answer in a very good way, because I think the Netherlands is an example of one of those countries in Europe and North America that initially did not take the pandemic very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think they waited too long. And basically that has resulted in the fact that almost from the start, they were running behind the facts. So they were not able to trace the contacts because there were way too many already. Mm-hmm. And that has resulted in a large number of infections, but even worse, in a large number of dead people. And I think the Netherlands, you know, when you compare to Malaysia only now 107, 108, something like that, death. In the Netherlands, officially, more than 5,000. In reality, probably around 10,000, because they're only counting the ones that die in a hospital that had a confirmed infection. So that's a very, very big difference. You know, it's half the population of Malaysia, and many, many times more death. And, you know, that's true for many Western countries. And I think in comparison to Malaysia, and, you know, I think particularly the Ministry of Health, the director, have done a great job of taking this serious from the start, follow up, do all of the contact tracing, isolating them, and so on. So, yes, here, much better than in Europe. I'm happy to be here. It's much safer.
But Professor, one of the things that's been a hot topic, I think when we're watching the WHO press briefings, as well as the different press briefings that are occurring around the world, the question that's on everybody's minds is when is a vaccine for COVID-19 going to be available? And looking at whether this is something that can be envisage in the next couple of months, if not even sooner. We're talking about 1 year, we're talking about a few months. There are different discussions as to when a possible vaccine is going to emerge. But one of the points that has been highlighted is that there are only a few countries, really, that are basically developed countries that are able to have the high level expertise, knowledge, and production capacity to be able to produce vaccines. So before we go into the discussion about a vaccine for COVID-19 specifically, or SARS-CoV-2 as the virus is for COVID-19, could you share with us a little bit about what are the steps involved in getting to a vaccine? How is a vaccine developed from start to finish?
Step one is the scientific idea. So basically the science of it. And there's many groups that have done that. So there's more than 100 groups in the world that have come to a form of a vaccine. And that can be all kinds of different things. So The easiest, most classical one is with an inactivated virus. So basically the virus is killed and then used to vaccinate. The second one is to make a virus, usually through culturing it in vitro. That's much weaker, so-called attenuated virus. A third way is to put the virus in another bacteria or yeast, or most commonly put it in a in another virus, harmless virus. So usually adenovirus, lentivirus. And then there's newer ways where people have been using RNA technology. So basically it means you're taking the RNA, which is genetic material of the virus, and inject that directly in people. And then the cells of that person will make the viral proteins, and then the immune response will react against that. The idea of all of these different methods is to have the body make an immune response against the virus, which is there before you meet the real virus. And the immune response basically consists of two different parts. One, and that's what people talk about all the time because it's easy to measure, one is the antibody response. So these are antibodies that will recognize the virus, catch it, and make sure it gets destroyed. The other, more difficult one, is the cellular immune component. These are lymphocytes, blood cells, that actually will attack cells that have been invaded by the virus, will kill that cell, and then in turn the antibodies will take care of the virus. Because as long as the virus is inside the cell, the antibodies will not attack it. So you need both components. But people usually only talk about, you know, the antibody part.
The antibodies.
Much easier to understand. Yeah. So basically that's step one. Then step two is that you have to test such a vaccine first in preclinical studies, basically in mice or other small animals. And you look at things like safety at that time. And you can also look whether there is a immune response. And then, you know, that part has been done by all 100 and something different groups in different parts of the world. Then the real difficult part is coming, and that is doing the clinical studies. And the clinical studies traditionally are divided in three, one, two, and three. So stage one, you take a small group, you know, 20, 30 people, you inject the vaccine, and all you're interested in basically is whether it's safe, so whether there's no harmful side effects. And two, you can also look whether there is, for instance, an antibody response. So that's one, and you know, nothing more. After, when that's done and it's safe, the next step is to take a larger number of people, you know, several hundred people, inject it, and basically, again, you're looking at the same thing, but you're also particularly looking at whether there's a good immune response. Mm-hmm. And when that's also done, again, no safety issues and things are looking good, then you can go to stage three, which is a very large number of people, 5,000 or more. And then the difficulty, which will also be the difficulty with this virus, is that you can only test that by immunizing them, and then you have to wait. Yeah. And then, of course, some of them will get infected, but not all. Most of them will not get infected, you know, over a prolonged period. Because if you look at, you know, it frequently it's only one in thousands of people that gets infected. So that's a big problem. And so that's also why it can take so long before you know whether it's really effective, because that's the proof of the pudding. You know, somebody that's immunized and meets the virus and does not get the disease, or to a much milder degree than people that have not been immunized. There's one way around it, which is heavily debated at the moment, which is it's called a human challenge. And basically what it means is that you take volunteers, you immunize them, and then you let them meet the virus. Mm. So you infect them on purpose. And that's something that has been done for some viruses. There's some debate whether we should do that now with this coronavirus. When you do that, it's much quicker, of course, because then you can see very quickly whether those that have been vaccinated are protected. The downside is you will also have to infect some people that have not been immunized and that run some risks. So you can only do this when you have a group of people that's quite healthy, you know, where we know young people, the risk is quite low, and you have some good medicine that you can use to treat those people that actually do get sick. Mm. And so I don't think it's been decided yet, but this is one of the things people are considering. If that is done, there can be a vaccine much earlier than otherwise.
But Professor, you just described quite an evolved process of deliberately testing with starting with smaller cohort sizes and then going to a much more larger group of people. What is the typical time frame for a vaccine?
The typical time frame is many years, you know, 5 years, 10 years even for some. Here they hope to have a vaccine in a year. I think that when steps can be taken, such as this challenge approach, it can indeed be, there can be a vaccine by the end of this year. Mind you, and WHO also repeated that yesterday, there has been so far no successful vaccine for any coronavirus. So, you know, that's something to keep in mind. But there are a few things that give hope, which is that a few of the groups already now are in stage two, so already testing in, you know, in large groups. And the other thing is a few of the groups also have been testing in monkeys, macaque monkey, for instance, and have shown that they do get protective immunity. So when you infect them after the vaccination, they do not get sick. And the ones that did not have vaccination and were infected did get sick. And, you know, monkeys are pretty close to humans. So it's a lot more reassuring when it's working in monkeys than when it's working in mice, for instance.
Mm. Professor, after the clinical trial stage and comes market access, well, actually before that, it has to go through approval, of course, and then we come to market access. Could you take us through those steps?
Yes, approval. So, you know, all of the groups that seem to be successful at the moment already are in negotiation with the approval authorities and so on. So I think that will go remarkably fast this time. Then there's another big hurdle, which is the production, you know, because basically we are talking here about not millions, but billions of doses that may be necessary. Again, there are a few groups that already are setting up a big production facility without even having the approval for the vaccine. That's taking a risk. But on the other hand, it means that once they have proved that the vaccine is working, they can go very quickly and produce large amounts of doses. It is a risk. They will be, you know, they risk millions and millions of dollars in losses if they are not the winner. But it's one way in which this can be done. And then, you know, once you have produced that, it's about how will it be made accessible to people in different parts of the world? You know, there will be countries that will first think of themselves. There are also consortia where, you know, groups from different countries are involved, etc. WHO tries to coordinate some of these things. But in the end, you know, it really is still a political, probably also economical question of how it will be available to different countries.
So, Professor, the burning question that for a lot of people are going to be asking is how much is that vaccine going to cost? And it goes back to the earlier question of how much does a vaccine cost to be produced? What is the typical cost for a vaccine in terms of production?
You know, I think that's extremely variable. If you produce, you know, millions, billions of doses, then the cost can be very low. So when you look at some of the vaccines that are being used routinely now, I think that the price has been brought down very significantly, which could also be done here. I think this is, you know, a global emergency. I think there will be several mechanisms that will make sure that there will be vaccines at very low cost, or perhaps in many countries, I think it will be at no cost at all to the individuals. How much it is, I've not seen any mentioning of, you know, what people are thinking to do here. I think there's a lot of companies that are more interested in doing this to show that they care, and actually that they are a company. And of course, universities do it basically also for free. They do it because they want to serve mankind.
Of course.
And I'm pretty sure that there will be, it will be available for a reasonable cost.
Of course, the economies of scale will definitely come in when it comes to looking at this vaccine being rolled out into production when it finally does. And because, as you said, it's going to be involving billions of dosages. But doesn't the research and development, as well as the production, even the market access, also depends on whether this is a single dose or multi-dose vaccine? I mean, obviously, we're hoping for the best, which is a single dose vaccine. And I'm certainly hoping that's the case. But it could also mean that if it's a multi-dose vaccine, then it could be even more expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, there's some talk about that, you know, coronaviruses, generally the immunity does not take all that long. So there are some people that think it might be something that you might have to repeat every year. It's possible. But again, even then, it would be pretty much mass production, and the price also would be quite reasonable, I think.
So there's a global consortium now that's involved in it. Gavi, I think, the Global Vaccine Initiative. And there's a lot of money that's being put into the development of something that would be considered a global vaccine. So when that gets developed, how do we look at the issue of intellectual property in terms of looking at patents, approval of the use of the vaccine in countries like Malaysia? Would it go through an expedited process or an emergency kind of usage agreement? I mean, how would that look like?
Well, I would assume that every country actually would do this on an emergency basis. So I think that once, you know, it's been shown to be safe and effective, I think that all countries will jump in very, very quickly. And I don't think that intellectual property will come in this all that much. You know, there's a whole range of different methods. Many of them have been used for years already before. So there's not much, the sequence of the virus is, you know, in the common domain. So yeah. I don't think that will be very big issues. You know, really this is an all-out effort by scientists and companies all over the world. And I would think that a big majority of them does this for mankind and not so much to make a profit.
The scientific motivation may be to find this vaccine that will benefit everyone. But like you said, ultimately, there are political and economic factors that determine which country gets its hands on the vaccines. If you look at some of the vaccine candidates that have entered clinical trials, they're being driven by specific countries. If and when their particular candidate does get approval, does that mean that that particular country owns it and, you know, sort of gets to corner the market on it?
Well, the company, not the country, but the company basically, you know, owns it because the company has produced it. So let's say these three front runners are United States with some of the companies, United Kingdom, Oxford, but together, I think, with one of the big pharmaceutical companies, and of course, a couple of initiatives in China. And then, you know, there's many more, but those are the three, I think, that are now have one or more vaccines already in phase two trial. You know, all of them pledge to make, you know, large amounts available, but we cannot know now what will happen, whether they will first do their own country. You know, the things you can look at is which people should really get it. Those are people working in healthcare, and I would say in the broadest sense, you know, particularly also people working in old citizens' homes and care facilities, etc. because that's where, you know, we find the greatest risk. So healthcare, and then second, of course, these senior people that run the biggest risk. You know, the number of death in older people is so much higher than in younger people that is this time pretty clear that that's the risk group. People that have certain diseases, so people that have diabetes or have hypertension. In some countries, there's quite a strong relation between obesity and doing very poorly once you get this disease. So those are groups that one might look at. Some say children, but you know, the thing is that children so far have not gotten the disease very seriously. But those would be the first groups. But that already, of course, are millions and millions of people. So ideally, you would look worldwide and make sure that those groups are getting the first vaccines. And only after that, the question of whether you should vaccinate all people. So I hope that, you know, scenario one, where companies would look at making it available worldwide for those groups, I hope that will be the scenario.
This is the question that we'll be thinking of once we get hold of the vaccine for Malaysia, where we're going to have to look at prioritizing the different populations. And you just described various numbers of individuals who would be in first in line to be able to get access to this vaccine. But there is a discussion concerning whether or not herd immunity would be an approach that we would be able to consider. But even then, it would depend on how many people who are able to be effectively immunized against COVID-19, but also whether it would actually help for the elderly, the immunocompromised, and different vulnerable populations if we would go along that approach. So, if we're looking at what you recommended, we're looking at 30% of the population that we would actually have to ensure that they have access to this vaccine. Is this a viable strategy for a country such as Malaysia? Are we able to afford making sure that a third of the population is vaccinated?
I think so. Yes, I think so. And so, as I said, you know, first, people working in healthcare, very important, because you know the risk of spread in hospitals is the biggest risk, and care homes. Number two, you know, the risk groups, which indeed, when you take things like hypertension, diabetes, and when you add obesity, you get to a very large proportion of the population, and older people, which is a large proportion of the population. But yeah, you could immunize those first. So what I was saying is that the thing really is where to start. You know, you might be tempted to start immunizing everybody. You know, then the idea is herd immunity. I think it would be better and also more likely to start with the risk groups and then after that expand to the other groups.
You just heard from Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, and Professor Sibrant Popema, Tan Sri Jeffrey Chia, Distinguished Professor, as well as President Emeritus of the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. Professor Popema is also member of the board of Sunway University and special advisor to the Chancellor and the CEO of Sunway Education Group Malaysia. This is the first of a two-part segment on our public health series. We've been looking at the development of a vaccine for SARS-CoV-2, and that's the virus that causes COVID-19, and how the development of the vaccine worldwide has been coming along. What do we project to be the timeline for a vaccine to be available to a global population? In part two, we will be looking at where Malaysia is on this map. What's our vaccine R&D capacity? And what's the impact of that on our health security, especially in times of a pandemic as we are facing right now? So stay tuned for part two on this public health series next Wednesday on the 20th of May at 4 p.m. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.